I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is OKCupid co-founder and author Christian Rutter. He's joined in conversation by Bold Italic Editor-in-Chief Jennifer Mares. And now join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Christian Rutter and Jennifer Mares.
Okay, now, Christian Rutter and Dataclysm, OKCupid. A brief survey, I just want to check how many of you have been on an OKCupid date? Excellent, we're like at like 98, 99%. All right, how many of you are on an OKCupid date right now? That's good, actually. I was like a little worried. Good, all right. So, as I'm sure you know, Christian Rutter is the OKCupid co-founder. He's a Harvard-trained mathematician, a rock musician, and a matchmaker to millions. We're pretty sure we heard him say there were 1 billion people on OKCupid, which seems, maybe I heard that wrong, but that's like an astonishing number of people. He's the author of OK Trends, the OKCupid blog, and is in the band Bishop Allen. He's here to talk about his new book, Dataclysm, where Christian's looking at the deluge of data that we're putting out there online, figuring out who we really are using that data, and also thinking about how to maintain privacy in this brave new world. And he's joined tonight by Jennifer Mertz, the editor-in-chief of the Bold Italic. So please join me in welcoming Christian and Jennifer.
Yeah, one small correction. I definitely did not say there are a billion people on OKCupid.
It's 10 billion people.
Credibility is destroyed before I even get out here.
It's 30 million people, though, right?
Yeah, we've had 30 million accounts created all time, but you know, because online dating is only good for one small portion of your life, we have about 4 million people kind of use the site every month, basically.
But I also saw a stat that a third of all marriages came out of online dating these days. Is that...
I mean, there's no way for me to know that for sure, but I mean, I don't know. It makes sense. I mean, it's a lot of people coming through there for sure, and other sites too, obviously.
Well, I want to talk about your book, but starting out, I want to talk about OKCupid and kind of the phenomenon you've been able to build up with your co-founders. So I was thinking, you know, you started in 2004, right? And back in that era, you knew people, like maybe there was an outlier that was on using Craigslist or using JDater. It was kind of like one out of every 100 people that you met used it. And now your coworkers are on there, your friends are on there. So how are you able to take this kind of germ of an idea that people should be online dating and make it into such a huge thing that so many people use?
Well, I mean, definitely the phenomenon word is not totally right. I mean, there's a lot of websites that I'm sure a lot of ones that people in this room use, like Pinterest or Facebook or whatever, that have this like hockey stick thing where they start and they get launched and the world is like, thank you, or whatever, or just the people start using it. But, you know, it was a long, slow burn. Like, OKCupid almost ran out of money in 2009, and we kind of turned a corner or whatever at that point. And, you know, obviously, we're certainly one of the biggest, if not the biggest site in the U.S. at this point for dating, but it took us a long time to, like, get to there. I mean, all we really did was try to focus on the problem at hand, which is to get people to send messages to each other. And just like in person, if you're at a party or whatever, it's hard to get guys to go up and talk to people they don't know, and women the same way. So it's kind of on the website to make that happen. And that's what we still spend almost all our time doing, but especially back in the ancient times.
So what were some of the big epiphanies that you've had along the way to get people to send those messages to each other?
I mean, there was a certain amount of grind to it. I don't know if epiphany is really, you know, I mean, it was really like, you know, this is the thing, and I'm sure this will come up, is when you're testing things on a website, you're designing how it works, it's like one thing is a couple percent better. And you do that enough, and obviously that accrues into a lot better, you know, but any given change, it doesn't really, it moves the needle, but only very slightly, or only if you're really paying attention. So, you know, we just honestly, that one of the biggest things that we kept at it, we were kind of lucky for sure. And you know, I think people's approach to technology generally changed in our favor, where, like, you know, I'm 39, so I remember definitely I have thought to myself, like, why on earth would anyone meet somebody who they met on the internet? You know, it just that they, like, you know, I'm from that era, just like, that's just weird. And so you know, obviously my mind has changed about that, but you know, I think in the larger world, like, people just use technology in a way that's much more like of a piece with the way they're living their life, you know. Whereas, you know, the old kind of online romance is like the You've Got Mail thing, where it's like Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks like sending all these dumbass messages forever, and like, and then they're like, oh my God, I love you, or whatever, and you know, and like, I think people that space between the online relationship, such as it is, and the offline component has really narrowed. Where now it's people exchange a few messages and they go and they get a drink, and the more people that are going and doing that, just like the better OkCupid is, the more people find out about us, and that's like really helped a lot.
And you're also really a precursor to people, you know, creating a profile and kind of curating their public image. I mean, there are people who probably put themselves out there on OkCupid before they ever did on Facebook, and now it's like, oh, you have all these different ways that you kind of project who you are out there. So maybe it's less of a big deal if you're saying your taste on a dating site versus, you know, on Facebook or on any of the other social kind of platforms.
Right. I mean, yeah, I mean, people, Facebook is built in a certain way to reflect people's lives, you know, and you can find your parents or your, you know, people that you met, you know, that you haven't seen for 20 years that you went to high school with or whatever. And so people are just more comfortable with that idea, or they recognize that they're the two things, the kind of like digital world and the physical world or whatever you want to call it, can be a lot more closely intertwined. Definitely than like the late 90s or whatever, which is just, it's kind of a different scene over there.
I was also curious, or it was interesting to read that you've never gone on an online date. That yeah. Were all the founders in relationships when you started OkCupid?
Yeah, none of us.
So
how do you test out
what's working or what the experience is like if you never have to go through the agony of meeting a stranger and being like, that's not what I was promised on that profile?
Well, we have definitely been through the agony of meeting someone or going on bad dates, so, you know. Well, I mean, you know, like, that's the thing. Like, we really, we try to look at, and this is kind of why I ended up writing this book, is we had to use the data of what people were doing with themselves on the site to make decisions, you know? I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous amount of intuition that goes into it. But you know, you look at where we're going to make this change, and are people going to exchange more and better quality messages? And that, it's like almost tautological. If the answer to that question is yes, you accept, you know, you keep the change. And if the answer is no, then you get rid of it. So it kind of like, you know, we could have really screwed up, and if that had been the wrong proxy for success, if this kind of message health idea didn't actually correlate to people liking and using the product well, I wouldn't be here right now. But so it would have failed. So if we did have a kind of intuition, it was choosing that as the metric, because we could have easily been like, well, let's look at page views. You know, it's like how many page views. But in that way, it could easily be a marker of how dissatisfied people are. They're like, and they just go through and they don't like anybody, and your metrics are looking great, but nobody's actually having conversations that lead to dates.
So what is the ultimate goal of OkCupid? Is it to get people to fall in love, or is it to get people to send a lot of messages?
Well, it's no, it's I mean, that's the means and the end. So the end is to actually, well, first of all, like, people can use OkCupid to go have a one-night stand or fall in love or, like, you know, whatever the hell they want to do is totally fine with us. But you know, and the only way we measure our proxy for that outcome is messages, because I think if we try to do surveys or any of this stuff, you know, I mean, who knows? You could go run far afield that way. So, you know, and people ask me, I think the subtext of your question is like, how do you run a business where the success case for the business is people quit using your product?
Yeah.
I think that it is, you know, we've never paid money, we've never advertised, you know. So the only way that people come to OkCupid really is because they hear about it from a friend. They go to a wedding where people have met, and they're like, where'd you guys meet? OkCupid. Oh, cool. You know, it might not be relevant for them at that point, but if they break up with their person they went to the wedding with, then they're like, shit, what am I going to do? So in the same way, you know, people have roommates, you know, single people usually have roommates, and the dude walks out the door and his roommates know he met this cool girl on OkCupid or whatever. And like that's how these success cases generate more than we lose from them.
And I'm sure having your OK Trends blog has really helped too, because maybe you're out of a relationship, or you're in a relationship, or you're not dating anymore, but you're really curious, like, how does this work? What's the science behind who I'm attracted to or not? And I would imagine your blog has also done really well to help bring people back to the site too, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, It helps with SEO because legitimate enterprises link to our website, which is great. But it also, especially this was, you know, the blog launched in like 2009, and insofar as there was a stigma then around, there was more stigma then than there is now for sure, and it made it all right for people who are in a happy relationship or in a relationship to talk about a dating site, and it just made anybody it okay to talk about a dating site because you're having a dinner conversation, you're like, I read on this blog that, you know, whatever, and it comes up, and then again, like people, that's the weird thing about running a dating site is only a small portion of the potential audience out there actually needs what you're offering at any particular point in your life, in their lives. So, but you know, people remember and they're like, oh yeah, and then they get dumped or they dump somebody and they're like, yeah, I'm gonna try it. Okay, keep it, sure. So it really helped a lot, but that was a slow burn. Like it wasn't, if you go look at how many people sign up directly from the blog, it's like minuscule number. So it was like the equivalent of like a Coke billboard in Times Square where people don't see it and are immediately trying to find the next vending machine. You know, they're like, oh yeah, Coke, all right, whatever, and they get one at Chili's or whatever the hell it is they go to in Times Square. Yeah. So,
getting back to the messaging, one thing I thought was really interesting is how you kind of peel back and you're peeking at the messages people are leaving with each other, and I'll say too, you're not looking at individuals. Like you make it very clear in the book that you're not spying on OkCupid users, but you're looking at the data in aggregate, and you can see, for example, that a guy that cuts and pastes the same message, a very like personal sounding message of like, yeah, I'm really into camping and I lived in Montana for a while, whatever, that you're like, wow, this is to me. He cut and pasted that so many times, and he had a high success rate from that. And so,
sure. It's weird. I mean, computers obviously are very good at recognizing patterns, and so, you know, and it's a common spammer practice to send the same message over and over again because spammers are kind of basically lazy. And so we look for that all the time just because that's how we bust them. Don't be surprised. If any real scammer would not be surprised by this at this point. But so we look, and so we know if people are repeating messages, and I went to go and see, you know, there's people, normal people who aren't spammers when we go, like, dig into it. Are doing this, and so yeah, it'll be these like really customized. I mean, some of them are just like, "Hey, what's up?" And dude has pasted it to like 50 girls. But
I'm sure a lot of people.
And that you know, but sometimes people will be like, you know, yeah. I think there's one in the book where it's the guy's kind of has this very like, kind of flow of consciousness. I don't know if that's the right word, but in like this thing about architecture, and it's like very arcane and specific. And he said the same thing to like 40 women, you know. And it feels weird because a computer so literally can replicate things. But first of all, people have pickup lines that they go to in real life, and then also even deeper than that. I mean, I can think back when I used to go on dates, or when I've been doing interviews about this book. You know, you just run into the same questions and the same kind of situations, and you deploy the same stories. You know, almost verbatim. Not that I'm doing that right here, but you know what I mean. Everybody has done that thing where someone's like, "Where'd you get that scar?" Or you know, or whatever, and then it's that version of that. So like, that's kind of what I mean. Like the online dating might have been totally different than real-world dating, whatever that means, back 20 years ago. But now, like, a lot of the things that you see the analog is so close to the thing that happens in real life, especially because, you know, with the shortening of the distance between the online exchange and people meeting in person, like, most of what you have to say or whatever you're trying to pose in your profile basically gets fact-checked very quickly by people in real life, you know? Yeah. So, and people still obviously exaggerate their height or they pretend that they make $5 million a year or something crazy. So, like, that still happens just like it happens at a bar. But the kind of, like, kind of more material things where people, you know, catfish or whatever, it doesn't really happen in the way that I think a lot of people who don't know online dating well assume that it does. So.
Well, I was also thinking about how online dating has changed our fantasies and our disappointments of what we expect to meet. It's almost like shopping. You can be like, well, I want some 9.5 size Marc Jacobs shoes, and they're going to be in this color, and you can flip through and find it. Just like, I want a woodworking guy who's like 6'5" and likes Yola Tango.
Yeah,
and you think you can have this thing,
right,
and then he shows up and he's 5'5", and he kind of like sports with you, hey, or whatever. You know, yeah. It's like,
well,
you create these huge things that you think you're meeting.
I mean, more often you get that dude who likes Yola Tango and then shows up and he's 6'5", or close to it, maybe 6'3", but then you're like, you know, then he's got some other problem. Or you realize that like, you know, or that, like, that's not the end-all be-all of who you're trying to be with, you know what I mean? Like, that's a thing, that's why we try to get people to actually go and have a beer or coffee quickly, because, like, you know, how somebody laughs or, like, how their hair is cut or the sweater that they're wearing. Or there's like a billion physical things that you can never fold into a computer screen or get through a keyboard that are extremely important in deciding, like chemistry, right? And so, like, you know, that's the thing. Like, sometimes I feel like people are over-selective because they feel like these things are really important, that you like Yo La Tengo or whatever, you know? Like, my wife doesn't like the same bands that I do, although obviously if I had a checkbox, I'd be like, yeah, sure, we could sit around and talk about Operation Ivy or whatever, you know? And so, but who cares? So I think that I think is a downside, is that the people feel too... This sounds very weird to say, but I think the people feel empowered to make decisions that don't necessarily lead to what they're actually trying to get to.
Yeah, and that's what I'm curious. Like, how does OkCupid, is that something that you consider, you think about? Because I think, are we bossing ourselves in a corner by thinking, I can pre-select all these things until I get done the narrowest sliver of exactly the kind of man or woman I want? How do you break out of that and get people to take chances or think beyond what they think they might even want to meet?
Yeah, I mean, we think about that all the time. I was talking to some people upstairs. There is a whole suite of features that we have actually made and could launch, and that we know if they were used right would make an experience better, but people would just blow themselves up, you know? So, like, you know, and an example is, like, a lot of women get too many messages on OkCupid, and we don't want that. They don't want that. And so we could offer filters, but for the filters to be powerful enough to do the job that a person who wants that feature wants it to do, you could very easily have somebody who sets it into this extremely narrow criteria where they get no messages, you know? And then they're like, I'm leaving, you know? And so, like, that's like, we have to weigh that kind of thing all the time, because you have to, it's the power user thing, and also people just don't always know themselves, you know? So I'm sure I could sit down and go on a list of, like, deal breakers or whatever that would not actually be deal breakers when it came down to it, you know?
And maybe that's an area where you get into stuff with OkTrends too, is showing people these are the things, this is where what you expect and this is what you get. Are kind of, there's some dissonance there, and this is where you can kind of break out of that and be, I guess, a better dater or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely tried to stay away from dating advice on OkTrends, especially, mostly because, like, especially when we first started writing it in, like, 2009, 10, 11, there was all this kind of, like, it was almost like a rumor of data that was out there, you know? Like, obviously, Facebook had tons of stuff, but there was just super tight lockdown. It was, like, pre-IPO, you know? And nobody was really talking about what this stuff is, you know? It just becomes big data. It was just a mysterious and therefore especially threatening. And so we just started publishing stuff that we thought was interesting, that obviously is from a dating site and has that as at its core. That's the reason people are making this stuff. But it didn't really. I tried to keep it from having to do too much with actual dating. Mm-hmm.
But you must get asked from people who are like, dude, how can I, like, really use OkCupid to my, like, what are the tips that you know from this data that you can be the super tips. OkCupid dater, right?
Yeah, I never have any good tips. So, like, you know, that's the thing. That might come from me not having actually used OkCupid to find a date, you know, because, like, it's too easy for me to say that, like, in the same way that we don't ever try to solve a problem at the company for any individual user, you know, it's a kind of thing where, like, and this is so cheesy to say, but, like, I really think the best thing you can do is, like, be yourself. Not because, you know, that keeps you from misrepresenting yourself to some theoretical other person out there, but it gets the person that you end up going on a date with is looking for you. You know, like, otherwise, if you're posing and, like, I pretend that I'm into sports or whatever, you know, then I get somebody who's looking for someone who's into sports, and that isn't me. You know, so unless you're planning on maintaining this charade for infinity, you know, it just helps you so much to just do whatever your thing is, to just, like, do it. And I know that's corny, but...
Maybe with a little copy and pasting if you...
Yeah, and if you can figure out how to copy and paste on a keyboard, that will help.
You're listening to OkCupid co-founder and author Christian Rutter, whose new book is Dataclysm. He's joined in conversation by Jennifer Maris on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I want to talk about your book too, Dataclysm, and the subtitle is Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Which I think I really like the idea behind this book. It's like you can talk to somebody, you can give people a survey, you can, you know, do a phone survey or whatever. You're going to get a certain answer. You're going to get an answer that people feel like maybe they should give you. And then you look at the data behind search engines, dating sites, social media, and is your idea that this is a truer self, or you're just getting a little bit closer to things that people don't necessarily want to reveal?
I mean, I think it's more the second. I mean, I'm definitely not going to sit here and say that I've figured out what the truth is of humanity or anything like that. That would be absurd. But, you know, I mean, just speaking to the subtitle, like, I tried to, especially because people do pose in person and online, obviously, I really tried to look at kind of observed behavior, you know, things that they do that aren't statements of what they like, that are actually who they like on OkCupid, for example, or only look at the kind of self-reported stuff as an artifact of that self-image, you know, and then compare the two, of course. So, like, the canonical example for on OkCupid is, like, you know, when you ask people, you know, what do you think about interracial relationships, you know, and it's 2014, and OkCupid, I think, probably skews more progressive than the rest of the country, and everybody says, yeah, it's totally fine. Of course, it's like, duh, right? But then when you go look at the data, you know, there are very clearly delineated lines in how people rate each other, how they message each other, who they decide to reply to, and all this stuff, and so you get to, like, juxtapose those two things, which, you know, obviously is interesting.
Yeah, and that was something I wanted to ask you about, because race is definitely one of the bigger, I guess, depressing chunks of data that you have in the book. You know, for people that haven't read the book, you break down men and women by black men, black women, Asian men and women, Latino men and women, and then whites. And black men, black women, and Asian men get 25% lower response rate than any other...
Right, they're like underappreciated, I guess, on the site. So, and it's not just on OkCupid, you know, that's one great thing about... something I really tried to do, especially when I was making a kind of stronger claim. In the book, I try to find other data sets, right? And so, you know, if you look in the book, there's Match.com, there's Date Hookup, which is another dating site that we run. All these things have different, very distinct user interfaces, distinct user bases, and Date Hookup actually is, like, disproportionately popular among, you know, black people and Latinos, whereas OkCupid and Match sort of reflect the larger demographics of the country. And all three sites have exactly the same trends. I mean, slightly different numbers, but the pattern is the same. It is depressing, I guess, but, you know, like, this is, like, people ask me all the time, like, what is the most surprising thing you found, you know, and, like, it's, you know, being an American, you don't you expect this kind of thing, in a sad sense. But, you know, it is weird to see. You know, I grew up in Little Rock, and I went to Central High, which was, like, the high school in the South that was integrated per force by Eisenhower. It was the first one. So that kind of, like, discussion was just part of, you know, we learned about it in school all the time. So I expected something kind of crappy, but it's still the degree to which the pervasiveness and through time too, like, these patterns haven't changed in the 5 years we've been looking at this stuff. It was surprising for sure.
So where does that come from? Because part of me can see, okay, well, people who grow up a certain way have certain cultural references. On one hand, yes, it makes sense that maybe you want to date somebody that has similar cultural references, but. Like, I was thinking about a friend of mine who's Indian, who is a gay man trying to date, and he messaged this white guy, and the white guy wrote him back and just said really bluntly, "You seem cool, but I only date white guys." And his, you know, his mind is blown, and it's like, you can now imagine somebody saying that if you were, like, looking for a roommate, or if you were, you know, right, obviously interviewing for a job, any other situation where you're trying to kind of, you have a pool of applicants and you're trying to figure it out. So what is it about dating that makes it okay for people to kind of... I guess go with these biases.
Well, I mean, I don't want to sit here and speculate about the origins of racism in the United States. So that would that's a question for people smarter and more knowledgeable than I am. But I mean, I think here's the thing: like, on an individual level, like, everybody has a type too. And I'm, before anyone kind of reacts to what I'm about to say, let me finish. So it's like, everyone has a type. So on an individual level, it's very hard to blame a person for what this guy said. Like, what can you do? Like, even if he himself decides, like, you know, I feel like this is racist. I should like other guys, but attraction, or guys who aren't white, like, attraction is such, like, an organic chemical thing almost, that it's like, it's very hard to, it'd be hard to change that, even if you were aware of it and wanted to change it, you know, which is an interesting thing to think about. Unlike, say, like, employment discrimination, where if you're like, oh my God, this is really what we're doing, we need to change this, and you can actually have a policy in place that works, right? However, on, like, a kind of, like, global or aggregate level, I think it does reflect how our culture has decided what is beautiful, especially, and obviously I think that is their racism drives that. You know, there's attributes of people that you know, you look at the latest like ingenue actress, you know, from Natalie Portman to Kate Bosworth to whatever Emma Stone or all of these people, they're, you know, all white. It's very rare that they're not, you know. And it's like that kind of thing. You can see it in magazines too, obviously. It's a known thing. And so the culture defines attractiveness in this way, and then people absorb it. And once it's absorbed into a dope person, I think it's very hard to change. So this is one of these things that I think it's going to take years of, it will take years to address.
As a dating site, is there a way to mix it up where you say, I know you've experimented with, you know, pulling people's photos off the site before, you had like a Love is Blind Day. What if you, have you thought about experimenting where you pull race as an option or a category off the site for a day and see, does that change how people interact?
We actually thought about that, but see, I don't think it will. And this kind of gets to my first point about like that guy, your friend, the dude your friend was talking to, like, we can't make people. That, especially attraction, is something that's very, very difficult to consciously change. You know, you can't, I don't know, it's very hard to imagine that actually working, you know? So we actually talked about removing that as a search criteria, but, I mean, people look how they look, you know? And it would just be very, very hard. We can't make people do one thing or another, and we wouldn't want to. And we could wish that it were different and deplore, I guess, the reasons that have created that situation. But, again, on like an individual level, we can't mandate that you want to sleep with somebody, you know?
Right.
Thank God.
Yeah. Well, the other difficult pill to swallow, I think, had to do with age. And so there's a chart in the book that talks about who women are attracted to between the age of 20 and 50. Women are attracted to men that are generally around their age. When they hit 40, they start to be attracted to men that are a little bit younger. Yeah. Versus men aged 20 to 50, and they're attracted to 20-year-olds pretty much across the board. So
yeah.
You read that and you think, this is really depressing. I mean,
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I will say, I've talked to this, you know, I was talking to somebody from the blog 538 the other day, and like the more time you spend with this data, like the more it confirms your like cynic's intuition about people, which is, you know, is a funny thing that like the kind of like folk wisdom about X, Y, or Z is often correct for very good reasons that it's, you know, had thousands of years to become folk wisdom, you know, but it's cool to see it with this specificity. That data is how people vote on each other on OkCupid, so you can kind of rate people's profiles basically, and it requires no, the voter doesn't have to put him or herself out there at all. You're just rating people, you know, we have a gestural thing like Tinder does now, and you're just like, no. That person doesn't know they're being rated. It's a very like shielded type of environment. And so it's kind of like a marker of that first impression of lust in this case, because the people are looking at someone to sleep with or go on a day with. So you do see, you know, when guys just are sitting here doing this thing and basically in private, you know, they all think 21, 20-year-olds are the hottest. But you do see when they have to actually put themselves out there and send somebody a message. So it's like very few messages go from 50-year-old guys to 20-year-old girls. I mean, again, thank God. But like... So you see these guys make this compromise with the kind of, there's like taboo involved, and there's you know, what they think they can get away with, basically, right? So you know they pride also, because, you know, if you're sending messages to women who are, for one reason or another, like really far out of your league, it's just not going to feel very good when you're like getting buzz off creep or whatever you get back. So like, so you see these guys compromise between, it's like, so there's like pride and lust, and like where they actually send the messages are kind of like right in the middle where they like split the difference. It's usually like, it's like 10 or 15 years younger than they are. It's kind of like the minimum viable age or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, that's
life. Well,
that's,
I understand this fits into the same category when you're talking about race. Like, you can't force people or even try to get people to be attracted to somebody that they're not. But what do you do with the people? Like, I know from friends' experiences, as they start to, you know, get out of their 20s and into their 30s and 40s and still want to find people on the site,
right,
they deal with either people that are lying about their age because they want to be, at least just on the site, and then they meet in person and say, well, I'm actually not 35, right. I'm 38 or whatever.
Sure.
So how do you... This
is the good thing about, like, the data that you find in OkCupid reflects a kind of seedier side of people in a lot of ways, right? But the good thing about it is, in that situation, if you're, say you're a 50-year-old woman, it can't possibly be a surprise that you're not as attractive as the average 20-year-old, right? I mean, I'm 39, and I know that I'm not as good-looking as a random 25-year-old guy you pull off the street, right? So, like, but on OkCupid, it multiplies your chances, and the guys that you do meet just whatever, 100-fold or something, you know what I mean? So like, the numbers game of it, and it's, I don't think of it as a game, but the numbers side of it and the liquidity of the dating market, if you want to think of it like that, is just so much higher than it is in person that you will find someone. I mean, and I'm not really trying to get anyone to sign up for OkCupid right now, but that's the advantage, I think, to that situation, where it's like the data reveals something that exists outside the world, not just on OkCupid, you know? But OkCupid is a way of both revealing the problem and then also kind of solving it in that case.
Well, you also, I talked about some of the heavier stuff, but you have some lighter stuff in here too, which are the lists of words that men and women of different races use to describe themselves. And I know you said you don't have them memorized.
No.
But they're funny, and just to add some levity to this conversation. Because it's such a serious conversation.
Yeah.
But so you have, you know, the most typical words for white men are things like ween, hunting and fishing, campfire, redneck, truckers, Jethro Tull, you know, these are like some serious, like, classic rock bros who like, you know, drinking beer.
Sorry, some hardcore bros.
You know, brewing beers in there. For black men, it's dreads, neo soul, Luther Vandross, Tyler Perry, dreadlocks. And then, so keep going. So Latinos, it's a lot of stuff actually about music, salsa, merengue, cumbia, musica, and then Asian men, and for Asian women too, tall for an Asian. So you start to get in these clusters of information.
Can I see it for just one second?
Yeah. I just want to read the antithetical words too, because those are really good.
Yeah, the antithetical ones.
As well, you have for white men the most, you know, the words that they guess they use the least.
That everyone else uses.
Everyone else uses.
Often, relative to how often white men use.
Yeah, slow jams, Robin Thicke, raised in New York City. For black men, I mean, these are so good. Tallest man on earth, Belle and Sebastian, magnetic fields, Yellow Tango, which is why I had that in my head.
It's a bunch of like really.
So
really
yeah, if you, I don't know if you want to look at it, but these are really funny to read. But I'm curious, what's kind of the deeper thing to pull out from these words? Are these kind of the cultural constructs?
Well,
this
is why I asked to look at this list, because like the thing that was most interesting in doing this is the way you set up the math is you're looking at to find out the words that are most typical of white guys. You like look at how often white men use a phrase, and then you look at how often everyone else does. And so by definition, the way I set it up is like the most typical phrases for white men are things that they use often and no one else does, relatively, right? And so for like the black male list, like the thing that was interesting to me is like the way I set it up was stuff that I don't know about, you know, as a white guy. And so like you like skip through them because I can only assume maybe you don't know who they are either. But like I had to look lot of this stuff up. Like I didn't know what like Zane or Jill Scott or The Coldest Winter Ever. Like I'd never really heard of these things. And so I had to go through. And maybe I sound like an idiot to everyone out there, and you guys all know this stuff. But like. You know, and same for the Latino and the Asian list. And so you kind of, the algorithm had spit out things that I never could have if I tried to sit down and write a comedy routine about what different races say. I would never have been able to come up with this, you know, and like I couldn't have done it a priori. And so it's kind of like the like shibboleths or whatever of these cultures that they typically talk about it and that I don't know. And like that was like the most fun thing, not to try to get all heavy again, but for doing that part of the book was like it had generated something that I couldn't have come up with.
So. Well, I think generally language is one of the most interesting things that you're looking at in the book, like beyond what's on OkCupid, looking at the language, like what do people put into search engines, and what can you learn from what people put into search engines, and what's happening culturally, you know, around that time too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Playing with Google Trends is something that everybody should do. It's really pretty amazing what's going on. Or like even the autocorrect thing. Like if you type, you know, why is my or why does my, and then you type a letter. The things that it says back to you is like this long list. If you type A and then B, it's like an alphabet of maladies. It's like, why does my butt hurt? Or like, you know, that might not be exactly what B is, but like it's that kind of stuff. I mean, it's the craziest.
Said, why is my husband gay? Is the gay is the last?
That,
or is
yeah.
my husband gay is the most searched thing with why is my husband? Or is my husband?
Yeah, if you type is my husband, you know, gay is the number one search that ends that query. And so that research was done by someone who actually works at Google from the inside. His name is Seth Stevens Davidovitz, and he's just done a lot of really interesting stuff. But yeah, like so, and he found that you know, that search is disproportionately common in states where gay marriage is most repressed or illegal, or however you want to look at it. So, you can kind of get at this like, again, like the public-private type of difference, you know, the schizophrenic way that these things are approached. you know.
And also predict things, like you talk about gay marriage and people being a lot more, the public acceptance of gay marriage and the states where that's happening, and, mm-hmm. and looking at where, I can't remember if it's where those kinds of things are searched more often, or where gay porn is searched more often, you can kind of see the...
Right, I'm going to have to try to pull this out of memory here, but I think, yeah, Nate Silver had done a prediction about where gay marriage was going to be legal next, and he had run through this kind of, like, he created this sort of, like, tolerance index, and this guy, Seth, went through and correlated that tolerance index with the frequency of searches for gay porn, and you find that... I don't want to say they correlate because the searches for gay porn, the number of people searching, oh, that's what it is. So the kind of underlying fact here of this data is that the per capita number of searches that happen for gay porn is even throughout the United States. It's not any more or less in Mississippi than it is in San Francisco or California or Rhode Island or whatever. It's flat, which indicates that if you kind of believe that people generally use Google all the time and if they want porn, they'll go there, that there's the same number of gay men in all of these states proportionally, right? And so, therefore, when Gallup does a survey to find out how many gay men there are in the United States, but they get widely varying numbers. Like in Mississippi, it might be 2%, and in Hawaii, it might be 5 or 6%. And so the theory here is that discrepancy is the kind of the people who are truly in the closet. Like they won't even report to Gallup that they're gay, right? So if a state is reporting 2% gayness to Gallup, and then yet, as Google has measured, that it's actually 5%. There's that 3% of the world that's in the closet. And the research was that the number of people in a state that is in the closet is inversely proportional to how tolerant the state is by this index. So you can see, it's kind of like you're able to like actually measure the oppression. And it's not a situation where, I'm from Arkansas, where it's illegal and people are like, forget this, I'm going to move somewhere where I can live my life. People don't do that. And they're there, and you kind of get a picture of the kind of cost of that through the data.
And looking at the search engines is really fascinating too, because it's like you're kind of listening, like eavesdropping in this special kind of way where people would never report like, oh, I have questions about I want to find gay porn. I have questions about my sexuality or any kind of right. question that you would be really embarrassed maybe to even ask your friends. You'll put into Google, and then Google can find trends and kind of pull information
yeah,
out of that.
Yeah, Google is an intense combination of, like, confessor and, like, doctor and, like, confidant and all this stuff. It's really pretty insane. I mean, the other time that I use, that I look at Google search results is also based on this guy, Seth's work, is that, I actually met him in person, and then we were just talking about random stuff. He knew I was working on a book, and he told me, which he later published in the Times, that the all-time peak ever at Google for searches for the N-word was on the night Obama was elected the first time. And so you go back, and I went back to Google Trends, and you can sit there and see. If you look at it, it takes a little bit of futzing to get the dates to line up because they normalize all this stuff. But you go through and you look at the 2008 election cycle, including the primary, anytime it got tense, searches for that word spike, So it's like, Iowa, and then there's the Pennsylvania primary on like April 20th or whatever it was, and it's tense, and so there's a spike, and then Hillary concedes, and there's another spike, and then there's this monster spike that dwarfs everything on like November 4th, 2008. And since then, that's the all-time high. And interestingly, this pattern did not repeat his second campaign. And the only other times that even roughly similar peaks have happened was the kind of week that Trayvon Martin's murder was really getting a lot of publicity with the protests and stuff, and then the week that Zimmerman was acquitted. So you see these like very intense... it's like a cathartic thing. So there's all these people getting very mad, and there's tension, and they Google this stuff. And then searches just bottom out after these huge crests. It's an interesting look into the psyche,
So I guess what would be, I know this is beyond what you do, but what would be the next step for that? If you're like, okay, there's all these racial slurs coming out, from these areas at this time, you get that data, and then what do you imagine is the next step in dealing with that?
People always ask me that when I talk about the race stuff, like, what is this good for? And it's a great question. Because the answer is, I don't really know. I think I wrote the book especially because, the what is it good for question is... been asked by, too many computer science majors to too many philosophy majors in the world, So it's like, it's a question that I like react against, even though it's, in theory, I'm the one who should be asking it. So I think there's value in knowing things, period. But then also for something like race, like it's something that's so taboo, it's so emotional, and it's so ingrained, it's so easy to take anything for granted or make these totally false assumptions, that having data that you can go look at and that you can't really argue with, like, helps people understand what's going on. And like, that clarity can only be a positive thing, you know, among people of goodwill, right? So that there, it's like, you know, awareness is such a kind of like flaccid goal for anything, but there, I feel like that actually is a worthwhile thing to talk about, or a worthwhile reason to publish this kind of stuff.
I mean, it does seem to be a theme of your book of like, I'm at least opening up conversations for people to take them from there.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features OKCupid co-founder and author Christian Rutter, whose new book is Dataclism. He's joined in conversation by Jennifer Mayers. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
On the more concrete side, though, you talk about Google flu, and you talk about people putting into search engines, trying to figure out what the side effects are of certain drugs before the FDA has even recognized that these are side effects. So, In other cases, there are, seems to be, you can pull search queries and kind of do something very concrete with it.
Yeah, I mean, Google flu was like a huge success story for their kind of data science team. And it, since people have called it into question, like how effective it actually is. And I guess last flu season, it didn't do very well. But the thing is, I'm sure it will get better. It's something that I think Google has done a really good job at kind of telling the story about how they use their sort of aggregated data to make the world a better place. You know, whether it's in conjunction with the CDC or you know the drug side effects with the FDA. I think Facebook actually does a lot of really interesting and positive research, but they just haven't done as good a job as like packaging it as a word, like Google flu or two words, because they publish a lot of really, you know, like world-class scholarship that comes out of there, like, or at least, you know, meaningful papers. It's like been very interesting to see that arise both at Google and Facebook, because obviously those places are way bigger and touch many more people than OkCupid, to see them sort of take up this idea that there's something for the larger world to learn about from what they're gathering or what people are giving them.
And then another area you look at is Twitter. So you look at search engines, social media, dating sites, and then Twitter. Mm-hmm. And one thing I thought was fascinating, even though you're like, well, I guess it sort of makes sense, is people really like to attack the easiest targets on Twitter. And the angrier you are, the more you like really wrangle people up, the higher your ranking is going to be on Twitter. And you talk about Justine Sacco who made the unfortunate, very inappropriate AIDS joke when she was flying to Africa, a country in Africa, and then people started this hashtag, you know, has Justine landed yet? And just this, like, how we're really eager to pummel people and how that raises, you know, people's rankings in general, which kind of goes along with the media, I guess.
Right.
You know, if you write really angry blog posts and you wrangle people
you're going to rile people up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that chapter in the book, I kind of take a more anecdotal approach. I mean, that happened with Justine, and beyond the substance of what she tweeted, which, you know, I think she would agree now is a bad idea, obviously, but also, you know, it was offensive, and you needed to kind of know her, which obviously the world doesn't, to know that it was a joke, and it didn't go off very well even at that. So, you know, take that and put it aside, the content of what she tweeted. But the reaction, no matter what she had said on Twitter, like, was so out of proportion. It was like, you know, she lost her job, which is one thing, but you know, there. If you look at the data, you know, she had been sort of called to task by like 60 million people or something in the first 24 hours of that phenomenon. And when it reaches that degree, you know, then you have people that take it upon themselves to go like follow her around or like call her family or all this crazy stuff. And like, I'm definitely not trying to make a martyr out of anyone in particular, but like, the like scale of rage was so out of proportion to even if she had said something truly vile, which people do on Twitter every second, you know, that just made no sense. And so, but it was kind of like, you know, when you hear someone use a word that you haven't heard before, you sort of hear it everywhere. And so she did that on like December 20th or the 21st. And then like over the next 2 weeks, I saw two other people be sort of subjected to this like rage machine. You know, there was a girl in high school in North Carolina that on the turning of the new year to 2014, you know, she tweeted out, which was way more clearly a joke. And like, if you go look through her Twitter feed, it's like full of jokes. She's actually really funny. She was like, I can't believe this beautiful world is, you know, 2014 years old, you know, implying that, that the calendar date is how old the world is. And people just went crazy. Like, just, you know, she, that thing was retweeted. That one tweet was retweeted almost as much as, like, Katy Perry's, you know, New Year's. She has the most followers. Katy Perry's New Year's greeting, Lady Gaga's, just completely out of proportion. And, you know, the first kind of round of the retweets were like, haha, or you got to be joking. But then the farther you get away from her in the thing, you know, it's kind of like the crowd throwing the stones. Like, people just start to disassociate from what's going on. And, like, people are like, you're an idiot, you're dumb. Like, it, obviously, they're getting a lot more personal. And then there's, like, go kill yourself. And it just, like, people in Denmark are telling her to go kill herself. It just makes no sense. And so, and she actually, you know, I didn't talk to her personally, but she did talk to and did some interviews that I read. And, like, she's kind of just blew it off, which is to her credit. But it's just, it is definitely an insane, it's an insane lever that you can, it's like, you know, you have a fulcrum and a lever long enough, you can move the world, and this it does, and it, for very bad reasons a lot of the time.
Yeah, this, I go back and forth, because sometimes I feel like people, somebody will say something really idiotic, and especially in San Francisco, there's usually somebody that's ready to, you know, tweet out,
sure,
you know,
yeah,
something that's very
idiotic. People
say idiotic
things in New York, too. Newsflash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was thinking specifically about, you know, people who have worked at tech companies and made cracks about homeless people or whatever, and these things build up, and then it's the same kind of crazy
sure.
death for whatever kind of thing on one hand, but on the other hand, it does help move a conversation forward. So it's the same kind of idea where you can either hide these feelings and nobody knows that you think this about homeless people or about black men or about whatever, and it never gets talked about, or you can nice. Say your opinion and get, you know, pounded, but ideally, I guess, these things will continue to help us have a conversation about, you know, class, race, these sorts of things that we think, oh, we're beyond all that, and yet these things poke out to show us that, you know, we're not.
Yeah, for sure. Although, I mean, to the extent that any of these people are sort of civilians and not, like, actual public figures, I don't know the tweets that you're talking about in California or here, but, you know, like, people are saying awful things to each other all the time everywhere, you know, and it's just like, the amount of just ice-cold rage that it generates, I'm not convinced that's actually very productive. I mean, I think, you know, like somebody, in Justine's case, like somebody, a snarky webmaster out there decided to register her name and had it redirect to donations to some site, to a charity that collects money to do AIDS work in Africa. I don't know exactly what they do. But, you know, that site probably got, I think at the time somebody went and interviewed them and they were getting a couple $100 an hour or something. It was, like, meaningless, essentially, right? And so, like, people want to think that this rage is serving some purpose when really it's just gratifying some extremely base instinct. And, like, to the point of, like, the thing that most recently happened is this thing on Reddit where they published these new photos of people like Jennifer Lawrence. And it's, you know, it's just totally disgusting. And then they're trying to high-five themselves because they're also raising money for, like, prostate cancer research. And it's just, like, so gross, you know? And, like, but an interesting difference between what happened, you know, a year ago with Justine and what happened over this Jennifer Lawrence thing, and there were other people involved, too, so not to bring it to her, but, like, you know, I did sense a kind of people being like, wait, you know, this isn't that great that people can, we've created this site. In the case of Reddit, they actually banned the thread, which they don't often do, where it's like, this is not what we want to be facilitating. This is not why we created the site, you know? And it's an amount of soul searching that heretofore has been pretty rare. And so I just, you know, I think I was talking to somebody about this on the phone about a couple weeks ago. Like, I think, you know, these things are so new that kind of etiquette and even just understanding are trailing far behind the actual practical implication or the practice of these things. And so, like, I'm hopeful that the understanding and the etiquette are catching up. And so, you know, yeah, I haven't been checking Reddit very often lately. I'm just kind of like, I'm out. So.
Well, I think another area, too, where we're trying to figure out the middle ground, you know, we talk a lot about data, and a lot of the data in the book is either, you know, kind of stuff about language or stuff that's kind of fun, stuff about dating. But when you get into the deeper things about how is the government looking at, you know, information, how is the government looking at activist groups or certain organizations, then it's not as fun to say, well, this is the words they're using, this is what their messages they're sending to each other. So yeah. You want to talk about that kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book to tell the kind of like what I feel like is the positive side of something that generally is either scary in the government case or kind of just like dollars and cents, sort of boring in the marketing case. But I think a very important difference of what, and I don't know anything about what the NSA does any more than any of you guys. Obviously, I don't have an inside man over there. But I will say, like, you know, when you post a baby picture on Facebook or like something, like, they don't care. Nobody is looking at what you're doing. You know, they're looking at it all in the aggregate, and maybe it's to try to sell you something. Most often it's probably to make the site better, but they're looking at it's all added up. Like, if I go do something on Facebook, they just don't care what Christian Rutter does. Not only do they not care, they can't even find out, really, you know, unless somebody goes rogue, and I'm sure they get fired. But the big difference between that and then what the government does is they do care about the individual. Like, they're really looking, they're trying, when they start wondering about what's going on in the data, they're not trying to wonder if people are more or less angry about the United States. I mean, some people are, I'm sure, but when it gets down to it, they're trying to go arrest somebody, you know, and like a particular person, not some cohort, you know? So like, that is when it gets scary, because they're parsing that thing in a personal way, whereas, you know, Google, Facebook, and definitely OkCupid. And, you know, we're trying to like find trends for a variety of reasons, but nobody's trying to track any individual down or ascertain anybody's motive. So, yeah, I mean, the NSA black box is definitely pretty frightening, but for that exact reason, that they care about you if you end up on some list, I assume, or trigger some flag in their thing.
But you also made an interesting statement that was something along the grounds of, you know, you can tell people all you want to worry about privacy, but most people aren't really going to care, you know. And I kind of agree with that. I mean, I have younger cousins that you can tell them all you want, like, don't post photos of yourself drunk all over the internet because employers will search that stuff, and they're like, you know, every weekend that's what you see.
Maybe they're going to go work for Budweiser.
I mean, not that NSA is going to care about that, but, you know, we're a culture now of we love to overshare and get likes and get feedback and put more and more and more information out about us. And it's fine if you're like a middle class person with no strong, you know, political necessarily affiliations, and you're kind of just floating through life. But if you move into one of the fringes and you're not doing anything dangerous, but you're oversharing still, you know, are we moving in a culture where people should be more concerned about privacy, or is it more up to the people that are that have this data, no matter what it is, that they need to kind of lock it down and make sure that they're not going to be sharing it with the government and make it clear?
Yeah, I mean, if you're planning on acting against the government, do not do it on Facebook. That is my first... My. If there's anything anybody takes away from this, that's what you should know. Go ahead and disable that right
Pin
now.
Pin all the guns you love in one...
Yeah, don't go doing that. It's an interesting question. I mean, like, but I feel like people's... Yeah, I mean, everybody has their own take on privacy, and there's a very valid kind of theoretical reason that even a person that has nothing practical to fear from the government would be bothered by the fact that they're basically recording cell phone conversations and all this other stuff. And so, the government side of it is, I don't know. I mean, they're like an organization that supersedes all of this other stuff, you know? Unless you really plan on completely checking out, like, completely, and even then, I think that means, like, not using your credit card. I mean, it'd be virtually impossible. That's the deal, you know. I mean, I'm not here to justify or say that's a good thing at all. It's a bad thing, but that's like where my ability to see what's going on ends. I know what happens at Facebook more or less, because that's also what happens at OkCupid. But the government side of it is unfortunate, and like unless people decide to elect people that they actually believe are going to put a stop to this sort of thing, then that is what it is. I mean, someone, whether it's Obama or Bush, they're, you know, in theory exercising the will of the people on this, unfortunately. And so I think, you know, it's a weak argument for sure, but that is something that I wish weren't the case. not to campaign for any particular ideology here, but like if this is the kind of thing that you can only solve at the ballot box, I think, because those are laws. Nobody can do anything about that. Or they're either laws or they're illegal, but still no one can do anything about it.
And we talked through a lot of different parts of your book, but now that you were kind of had your head down in data for so long, and you're pulling back up and you're doing a lot of interviews about it,
yes.
What's kind of haunting you and sticking with you and resonating with you about humanity, how people kind of operate based on the numbers that you've been looking at for so long?
God, that's a tough one. What is resonating with me about humanity? I mean, all the memories. I don't know. I mean, you know, I try to... Let me answer a different question. Because the thing is, you live with this stuff for so long, it's very easy to just absorb it, and it becomes like a reflex. Like, you know, I don't know if somebody who follows sports every day ever gets that surprised by LeBron James or whatever. It's just a thing that you sit around doing all the time, even though objectively it is remarkable, right? He is remarkable, and it's awesome to be able to look at all the stuff that people do. But like, what I really tried to capture in the book is just like all the different sides and the reach of what even now this kind of like very like elementary level people who look at this data are able to figure out, like, you know, Facebook, the reach of that site, that's where the 1 billion number came from the very beginning. You know, they have 1 billion monthly active users. That's like, and they're not legal in China, so that means it's like 1 in 5, you know, non-Chinese people on earth, you have a Facebook account, and they check it every month, which is crazy. And so they can go and they can look at really interesting questions that are beyond certainly a research faculty at Harvard or something, and they can go look at, you know, how people in Southeast Asia are relocating kind of in clusters to bigger cities as the country modernizes. You know, it's the kind of thing that happened in the Great Migration in the United States in the early 1900s, if you move into Detroit or Kansas City or Chicago or whatever. But they can go actually look at that thing happening in other places that they would never have even thought probably to investigate. You know, not a lot of research dollars going into this problem, you know, or this phenomenon is not a problem. So, and there's a whole myriad of things that are being revealed to these places, and I just wanted to, like, that to me is the kind of, like, truly, even though this whole data science approach to human behavior is very, very new, and there's tons of blind spots, and, you know, the book is more a look forward, but even at the place where we're at, there's, like, an amazing amount of stuff that people are able to find out or think about.
You have a lot of kind of numbers and language. Have you thought about looking at the visual things, like looking at Instagram and Pinterest and kind of pulling data and pulling out trends from more visual?
I did think about it in my, like, kind of fantastic world of when I was starting to write this book. You know, I realized how spoiled I was very quickly at OKCupid because we have just so much very, like, quantized data. But, like, a photo is very hard to analyze. I mean, there's obviously facial recognition stuff. But, again, like, I never wanted to, and I didn't get into what any individual was doing, you know. And so, like, being able to tell from a photo whether a person is even a man or a woman is actually relatively hard, even though that's a thing that they've gotten better at in the time since I started writing the book. But it's just very, it's like continuous data, you know, in a way, even though it's obviously digital. It has the feel of analogness from an analysis perspective. So I would have loved to do that. And, you know, maybe in 5 years when there's some sweet API, I can write Dataclysm 2 and look at that stuff. But I tried really to limit myself to things that I felt confident in, which, of course, is a limitation. So,
cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, everybody.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was OKCupid co-founder and author Christian Rutter, whose new book is Dataclysm. He was joined in conversation by Jennifer Maris. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature writer RJ Palacio. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.